Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal, come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. And before we go any further, I want to thank Bev Capshaw and Ronnie Elliott, who hosted the show last week in my absence, and once again did a fantastic job. They are great. Moving on, my guest today is James D. Osterley, an assistant United States attorney for the Western District of Washington. Osterley leads the Office of Environmental Crimes Working Group and prosecutes environmental offenses under the environmental statutes. It is tied to this part of his professional portfolio that earlier this summer, Osterley served as a faculty member for a two-week course on combating illegal wildlife trafficking at the International Law Enforcement Academy in Botswana. Among those participating in this course were investigators, inspectors, prosecutors, and magistrates from seven African nations. We'll hear what Osterley taught at this course, what he learned, some of the most notable elements of illegal wildlife trafficking currently, global enforcement efforts, and more when I speak with James Osterley in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later in the show, I'll speak with Don Goldstein, Talking Animals Greyhound correspondent, who will help us make sense of the improbable turbulence recently encountered by Amendment 13, which, if passed, would end greyhound racing in Florida over the next 3 years. The amendment was on the ballot, with its fate to be determined by voters on Election Day, November 6th. But, owing to a lawsuit filed by the Florida Greyhound Association, a judge recently ruled that the amendment should be removed from the ballot. Now the state is appealing the judge's ruling, so we will sort this all out, hopefully, with Don Goldstein's help later on in the show. Lastly, closer to the end of the program, when we play Name That Animal Tune, the prize will be a pair of tickets to see Bob Dylan, October 20th at Ruth Eckert Hall. Not bad. Right now, though, let's get to Jim, if I may call him Jim, with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. This is James D. Osterley on Talking Animals. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning, Duncan. It's Jim is fine.
Okay, good. That's good to know right off the bat. So I mentioned a moment ago that you lead the office's Environmental Crimes Working Group, and that involves prosecuting environmental offenses. What does that mean exactly?
Well, as some of your listeners might know, there's a host of federal statutes that govern environmental offenses. The most common are the pollution offenses. For purposes, I think, of our discussion today, there are a number of federal statutes that govern wildlife, offenses against wildlife, including wildlife trafficking. In addition to those specialized statutes, we've got a whole host of other, what we call Title 18 offenses, which are common crimes that would apply in many wildlife trafficking cases, such as wire fraud, mail fraud, smuggling, conspiracy. So that's what we do tend to use those statutes generally, because the courts are more aware and familiar with those than some of the more specialized wildlife statutes. So we've had some success in prosecuting cases using those types of statutes, again, because the courts understand them, and it's easier to convince a jury than some of these more lesser-known statutes.
So it's in part that they're more accessible and well understood or immediately understood, that then the effectiveness of prosecuting those crimes then goes up.
Right, and the other reason is the penalties are more severe.
Ah, okay, great. So it has some, it's not only not esoteric compared to some of the others, but it has some real force behind it.
We hope.
Yeah, great. So to what extent does working on environmental crimes reflect your personal concerns and passions?
I've always enjoyed the, being in our natural areas. My undergraduate degree is in resource management. I got a master's degree in the same field, and then one of the things that interested me about law was environmental laws, resource preservation, and then the extension to the animals obviously is, you know, that's a vital part of the ecosystem. So I've always been attracted to that area of the law, and fortunately was given opportunity to now work in that field.
Yeah. And so since that obviously was part of your academic studies, both the undergrad and master's, were you always kind of on a path towards that once you moved into a lawyer, became a lawyer, and then said, okay, well, this has always been my interest. If I can pursue that while pursuing my legal career, now we've got something.
Well, it wasn't that direct. I had, out of law school, I went to a law firm, partly because I didn't see a lot of opportunities directly in natural resource law and animal law, but I fortunately it was a good introduction to the law to work at in a private practice. But I had a colleague who had earlier left to work at the EPA here in Seattle, and he encouraged me to apply. I went to EPA. Again, was fortunate enough to get a position at EPA as their criminal enforcement attorney, and then transitioned after about 12 years there to the U.S. Attorney's Office here. And that's really where I picked up a lot of the wildlife, illegal wildlife trafficking practice once I came here to this office.
Okay, so it was a little more circuitous, but I take it that once you got to this office, it was partly with working in that specific field in mind, since you'd had that dozen years or so at the EPA prior.
Right.
Yeah, okay. And how important are animals to you outside of work, just personally?
I mean, I certainly love, my free time. I do spend outdoors, and in this area of the country, we've got a whole wealth of resources. So I'm out hiking, biking, and one of the things I really love is to encounter animals in that environment. So I've always, tried to, in my free time, experience the animals, but also, I like to keep educated, and I'm a little bit limited in how active I can be in some organizations because of my position.
Yeah.
But I do try to support the organizations that foster most, habitat development and preservation.
I see. And how about at home? Are there any animals that live with you at home?
We lost our two golden retrievers a couple years ago, and right now we're sort of taking a break.
I see.
We've always had dogs, and kids growing up had pets, reptiles, cats, all sorts of things that kids have.
I gotcha. Let me let folks know this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Jim Osterly, an assistant U.S. attorney for the Western District of Washington. He recently was among those teaching a two-week course in Botswana on combating illegal wildlife trafficking. If you'd like to ask Jim a question about wildlife trafficking or the other related topic or offer a comment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0800. So, kind of outline what the world of environmental crimes might encompass. What percentage of the cases that you and your office handle deal actually with illegal wildlife trafficking?
I don't know if I can put a number on it. At any given time, we've probably got, 3 or 4 cases being investigated and or prosecuted. It doesn't make up a huge percentage, mm-hmm. but I think if you compare it to other offices around the country, we do probably more than our fair share given the size of our office. And part of that is based on we have active agents that investigate the cases here. Do have something of a track record. We've been doing these cases in the office, both myself and then prior to that, we had another prosecutor who was dedicated to doing that work. So we've got sort of established track record of doing these.
In what ways are the cases, the 3 or 4 at any given time, are they specific to the state of Washington and the surrounding areas of jurisdiction? Is that how that works? And when you say that there's agents actively investigating that, are they because they're in that area or the trafficking is passing through that area?
A lot of it's trafficking passing through. We are a port, an international port, so
yeah.
We do get a fair amount of transiting wildlife specimens, dead and alive. And we've got, active inspectors at the airports that at times will come across traffic wildlife, illegally trafficked wildlife. We've got a pretty aggressive state office that will often refer cases to the federal authorities. So there's transit activity. There's selling activity out of the state. We've prosecuted people here locally who were engaged in international trafficking. We're not although we have done a couple of source-type cases, by that I mean people that are actually taking species out of this area of the country and trafficking them internationally. So it's a little bit of everything, but mostly we're a transit location, which is not unlike most areas of the United States. We source some out of the U.S., but a lot of it is coming in or being transited.
And that's, I guess, maybe more than some places because there is a port there?
Right.
Yeah.
Correct.
So how exotic are some of the animals that are trafficked through there?
A couple cases we've done, I've done recently, there's a fish called an Asian arowana that is prized in Asian culture as supposedly bringing good luck. We did a number of cases a few years ago involving the trafficking of arowana through the Seattle area. A lot of them were being sold here in the area, but some being shipped out. That particular species is what's called a CITES I, which is protected on the international level as the most highly protected. If you go into a lot of Asian restaurants, you may see a tank in the front with an Asian arowana in it. That's illegal to have, but again, they're viewed as being a sign of good fortune and good luck. We've prosecuted someone recently for trafficking in narwhal tusks. They were imported by this individual from Canada, where they were harvested, and then he then sold them nationally to his customers. Turtles, we did a case recently with an individual here in our district who was trafficking in turtles, both importing exotic turtles from Asia and then essentially bartering for turtles from the United States. And so he was prosecuted here for smuggling violations. It ranges, probably not as exotic as the African animals, but there are some here that are prized by people elsewhere in the world.
And I guess I'm not as familiar, compared with some of the other things you mentioned, with the narwhal tusk. What is prized about them, and how do those get used, and where predominantly do they get trafficked to?
It's an ivory product.
Okay.
It is not that different. I'm not a biologist, but it is not very much different than an elephant tusk.
It's
essentially a tooth. It is a tooth of the whale that grows, as much as 10 to 12 feet. It is trafficked and used the same as ivory. It's used for carving. It's a lucrative practice. An inch of narwhal tusk can be $300.
Wow.
So in any given tusk in the raw form, it could be $10,000 to $15,000 a piece.
So much like elephant tusk, I assume that's predominantly for the Asian market, then that's where the interest is strongest?
Yes, although, the U.S. Is a pretty big consumer of that product.
Oh, yeah? Okay.
A lot of the carving is done by both Asian carvers and Native American carvers.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's true. I hadn't thought about the carving as much as just sort of the medicinal value that's often assigned to some of those things that it's hard to reconcile sometimes. But so there's an emailer that's got sort of an overlapping question before we move on. So this emailer says, what is one or two of the craziest smuggling cases that he has encountered? Has there been anything that really shocked him?
Boy, I'm trying.
Sounds like the question itself may be a little bit shocking, but
I'm trying to sort through the cases I've had.
I'm sure.
I mean, I've seen and not directly worked many cases where people have smuggled in body cavities, smuggled on airports live animals that were sedated. They are as creative as your imagination in terms of how to get the animal or the animal product into the United States. They often put them in legitimate transport, so they'll hide it among other legitimate products. I guess the most shocking one that sort of resonated with other people in the office is I referenced earlier the reptile smuggler.
Yeah.
That case was discovered in part by a FedEx driver who had a box that she was delivering or picking up, and the contents moved. And so she stuck her hand in and found a snake.
Yikes.
The second part of that, my point is, through the course of that investigation, we learned how, in fact, they were smuggling reptiles, including turtles. And the turtles, and this is extremely inhumane, and the mortality rate was high, but they don't want to get detected. So in order to keep a turtle from scratching and making noises that would lead to detection, they use athletic tape to tape the turtle up and then stick it into a sock and put as many as, you know, they can fit into a box. And, you know, we've seized some of those, the agents did, and I've actually got a photograph in my office of a turtle with its head sticking out of all wrapped up with the exception of their head. It looks...
I think you sent me that photo, because I think I posted that, either that photo or something very similar when I was trying to help call attention to today's show, because it looked like there was athletic tape or something, and it's like, wow, this doesn't look like it was very good for the turtle at all.
Well, no, as I said, the mortality rate's high in that, and it's just a cost of business for these folks.
Yeah, wow. All right, well, let's take a caller, and then we'll move on to talking about the course in Botswana. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Jim Osterley.
Yeah, I am surprised and glad that a sitting U.S. attorney is allowed by this administration to even come on an animal rights activism show like Talking Animals. I don't know if you can even comment on what I'm going to say, but the Trump administration and Zinke have been rolling back both domestic and international protections that help to fight animal trafficking and trophy hunting and also abuse on factory farms. The other thing that you might be able to more easily comment on without worrying about your job security is that the CITES protections, the actual international agency that's supposed to protect animals from this illegal trade, is woefully understaffed, and most countries don't have legislation that has any teeth in it. Even if you see the movie The Cove, you can see that what we think of in America, that animals are protected, they're not. And I admire you for going full bore, full strength against all these cruel and terrible people that are destroying native species for profit and for fun.
Okay, well, I guess our caller's gone. I'm just going to quickly say that I don't consider Talking Animals an animal rights show, although it does cover animal rights, but part of the thing from day one, 15-plus years ago, was to have a much broader purview than just animal rights. But having said that, Jim, would you like to comment on any or all of the caller's comments?
I can offer this. Combating illegal wildlife trafficking really rose in profile back in the late 2000s when the link was drawn to national security, international crime. And I think to the credit of the past administration and in part the current one, that's continued. In 2012, then Secretary of State Clinton really sort of highlighted that national security, international crime link between wildlife trafficking and the profits from it and a lot of the terrorism activity around the world. Organizations like Al-Shabaab and Boko Haram finance many of their terrorism activities, radicalism, through wildlife trafficking because it's a low-risk, high-profit venture. So what that did was raise the profile of wildlife trafficking onto the same plane as drug trafficking, gun trafficking. And that then led to resource allocations to international wildlife trafficking. In 2013, there was an executive order issued by President Obama directing agencies to make this a priority. And again, that reinforced funding for many of these efforts. And that's in part the funding that funds the course that I attended in Botswana. That funding continues, and those efforts continue. So I don't want to get into policy, but all I can speak to is the funding that's still there, the resources that have been allocated to the problem. So I continue to do what I do. I haven't been told otherwise, and the cases continue to be investigated. So that's sort of the way it is on the ground, at least from our office's perspective.
So there's been no change in how the office works, how it allocates its resources, or any other thing. It sounds like materially coinciding with the change in the presidential administration.
I've not noticed any.
Yeah, okay. All right, again, this is Talking Animals on Duncan Strauss. My guest is Jim Osterley, an assistant U.S. attorney for the Western District of Washington. We're discussing illegal wildlife trafficking, global efforts to enforce laws against that trafficking, and going to discuss a course that was part of earlier this summer But we do invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. So, yeah, let's turn now to discussing that, that two-week course you helped teach earlier this summer in Botswana, and which carried the overall title, Combating Illegal Wildlife Trafficking. I'm interested in hearing all about the classes and the participants, but first, how did you end up as part of the faculty of that class?
The course has been offered for the last few years, and they like to include, when I say they, I mean the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, which is the U.S. agency who staffs the training and develops the curriculum for the course. They like to have an assistant U.S. attorney or prosecutor participate because some of the content of the course includes law enforcement efforts, how to prosecute. So I had offered my interest and then was selected to attend this course in June of this year. But I do know other AUSAs across the country who have also done the same thing.
So I'm trying to kind of picture how the 2 weeks were. So is there an array of classes each day? Is it like for the 2 weeks, is a certain class taught for the entire time, or does that vary from topic to topic?
It's well designed. What it does is there are sort of subject matter lectures and discussion at the beginning of the course, just talking generally about wildlife trafficking, some of the law enforcement techniques that are used both in this country and around the world to combat it. But then what they've done is work into that general lecture series actual practical problem where the participants can then, for example, walk through a very simplified trafficking case where you've got some information, you develop the information with undercover sources, confidential sources, and then you work through, for example, you go to the scene of a poaching incident and you process that scene, you collect evidence, you then prepare legal documents to get search warrants that you might need, and then you execute those, and you work towards the end, which is how would you prosecute this case? So it's a condensed version of what would take months or a couple of years to develop, but it sort of touches on the key elements of an investigation and a prosecution. And it's very effective, I think, at introducing some things the way we do things here and then how they might adapt some of that to their own practices in their own countries.
So it sounds kind of like there's sort of an interdisciplinary approach, but it sounds like from what you just described there that for at least the bulk of that 2 weeks that everybody is playing some sort of role in how that, I guess, hypothetical case would work, the kind of things that then they would take to wherever they came from to investigate or prosecute or some other role that's played in the course that's being taught. So it sounds like it's really over the course of that 2 weeks, it's a very cooperative sort of teaching and learning.
That's the goal. And,
okay.
And I think it was effective in the course I attended.
I guess I'm curious too with the way you've described it. Were there sometimes cases where instructors were in this part of this class, but actually they were sort of learning or quote-unquote students in another part of the class?
It was broken up at times, but for most part it was kept together.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I think you touched on it. There's sort of an interdisciplinary approach here because the attendees at the course were covered through the spectrum of who you would see in a normal investigation prosecution. You had inspectors, you had agents, you had rangers, you had prosecutors, and we actually had a couple of judges in the course. So it was an opportunity for those people to talk both between themselves, if they were from the same country, and then between countries.
And so was it predominantly attended by African people from various African countries, and then there was people like yourself that were bringing in the prosecuting and other kinds of expertise that they might try to apply to their situation?
Exactly. Okay. There were the instructors, including myself, there were four U.S. Fish and Wildlife agents from around the country and then myself.
Mm, okay. Okay, so let me, we've got a couple callers here. Let me get, I have plenty more questions about the course, but let's get some other people involved in the conversation. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Jim Osterley.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead, it's you.
Hi, just out of curiosity, for people who are considering a career in environmental law, after you graduated law school, what steps did you take to go into the type of work that you're doing now?
Straight from law school, I went into private practice, and I took every opportunity I could to work on environmental cases. In private practice, that scope is a little bit limited because it's defined by what your clients need and what their interests are, and those interests hopefully are compatible with your own, but at times you had to represent your client's interests, obviously paramount. As I said earlier, after several years in private practice, I went to the Environmental Protection Agency. I was encouraged to seek that opportunity, and once at EPA, obviously that's all they do is environmental law, and then branched out when I came here to the U.S. Attorney's Office. So I think in terms of development, obviously seize whatever opportunities you can. If you're in private practice, it's, develop clients with interests that are similar to your own, and then take on whatever pro bono work you can, working with organizations that protect the environment. There are very few positions like this, unfortunately. But the ones that are in it have a personal passion, and then also have had the good fortune of finding opportunities.
All right, caller. Well, thank you for your question, and Jim, thanks for your answer. And I would guess too that from the time that you went to law school, it would seem, at least from what I've been able to observe, that a number of law schools have added various kinds of animal law courses. Maybe didn't exist as much when you were in law school.
I think that's true. I actually every year go out to the law school here and teach a course on wildlife trafficking. I'm certain that was not something that was offered when I was in law school.
Yeah. So back to Botswana. So I imagine some portion of the time there was devoted to discussions of new methods for investigating and of course combating trafficking. Can you give us a sense of what some of those newer methods are?
I can speak broadly.
Yeah.
Obviously,
We're not trying to help traffickers beat the system. That's for sure.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there's technology, and we see it every other area of law enforcement. There's absolutely no reason why it wouldn't apply in this context as well. So there's intercepting electronic communications. There is monitoring those transactions, monitoring social media. The poachers at the base level are not that sophisticated, but the traffickers are, those that profit the most. So it's tracing money. It's all those things. I think most of the poaching is still pretty rudimentary. So I don't think that is anything new in that area. It's mostly once the animal's been taken.
Yeah.
And then you're just trying to trace the money and the product itself, and those are all, those are established law enforcement practices. It's not surprising there are confidential source developments. And in many respects, the NGOs, the non-government organizations that a lot of people are familiar with have been helpful in uncovering some of this activity.
So along those lines, and again, I'm sure the answer here, meaning the course of the Botswana class and those who are attending, would be quite a different answer than in your area there in Seattle and environs. But when asked what animals are the most poached in those areas, I think people would answer elephants or rhinos. But that's not necessarily the case. What are the most trafficked animals in those areas of Africa?
Well, those are certainly high because of the profit
to
be derived from it. But a lot of people are surprised to learn that the most trafficked mammal in the world is the pangolin.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, I gave a sort of a recap of the course here within our office recently and asked the question, how many people know what a pangolin is? And one person out of 50 knew. The pangolin is essentially a scaly anteater.
Yeah.
And I think for a number of reasons. One, it's highly accessible. It's not an animal that's going to run. Its defense mechanism is to stop and roll up in a ball, and so they're pretty vulnerable to poachers. And then the price being paid mostly in the Far East for both the scales and then the meat are is pretty high. So in an area that's already low risk, high reward, the pangolin is probably the lowest risk and the highest reward.
Yeah, and I think I may have mentioned one of my emails to you in recent months, because I was surprised. I mean, I knew about them, but I didn't know. At least some people have said that they're more poached than elephants or rhinos. And some have said they're more poached than elephants or rhinos combined. And, I mean, you would know better than I if that's an accurate statistic. But either way, I just think, like you say, out of that group that you spoke to about your experiences about Botswana back at the office there, you know, one out of 50 had heard of a pangolin. And so it's just so hard to kind of square people's unfamiliarity with that being at least as poached as an elephant or a rhino. But for the reasons you've said, well, I guess it makes sense. It's pretty easy a resource. And as you noted earlier, I mean, the poachers themselves aren't necessarily highly sophisticated in their methods, and you clearly don't need to be to grab a pangolin.
No. I mean, I've never done it, obviously, but what it's been described, it's not a difficult thing to do.
Yeah. And they're really, I mean, what familiarity I have of them, just seeing them on a documentary and some other stuff, they look like some sort of odd creature out of sort of Jurassic Park meets the Muppets. I mean, they look kind of dinosaur-like, but sort of cuddly in a weird way. So, I mean, that may also add to them being even more targeted, just because it's like, well, how could we really go wrong trying to snag this creature? But anyway, let's take another caller. Hi, you're on Talking Animals with Jim Osterley. Hello, it's you. Well, that call was waiting a long time. They may have left. Okay, so let's talk in our remaining moment or two about one of the things I've been interested in, because you often read or see a story about an armed squad that's protecting animals in one or more African countries against poaching. And one time it might be an all-female unit. The next it might be a group consisting of U.S. Military veterans. What are your feelings about those squads as a hedge against poaching?
You know, these countries, after being there and talking to some of the enforcement people, many of them are under siege. They're outgunned, they're outmanned. I think, you know, I'm sort of speaking for them. I think they would take the assistance they can get, as long as it's to have some control over how that is done. It's extreme. You hear about it, but until you actually talk to the rangers who have had fellow rangers killed, you can't appreciate the personal safety risks that they take to do their jobs. One gentleman from the Congo, you know, has had multiple colleagues killed. It's not uncommon to have a fellow ranger killed by a poacher. So I certainly can't fault them for engaging whatever resources they can. I think it is difficult to organize and manage that sometimes, but you know, I can't fault them for using the resources they have available.
Yeah, I don't know exactly how that works, but some of these that I've mentioned, the all female one and the one with the U.S. veterans, do they just offer their services? I mean, how does that even get sort of structured, where that there's some control or some coordination of who's where and who's authorized to do this, and again, if you're armed, who's authorized to shoot and what circumstances?
I didn't address that specifically with anyone there, so I'm just speculating here that I don't think there is a lot of organization.
Yeah.
I even within the regular military or ranger services offered in those countries, I think there is not a high level of organization to begin with. So you're already in an organization that's not, I don't think, maybe as regulated as you would think in this country or would expect in this country. So in many ways, it's still probably the frontier.
Okay. So it's kind of like, hey, this is so treacherous and out of control. We're just happy to have the help, and let's hope that it works out and just jump in.
Well, I know that's the case with some of these NGOs in providing resources generally, whether it's cell phones or equipment. You know, they will take whatever they can get because they're so under-resourced to begin with.
And what's, all in all, I mean, I know you were in Botswana as an instructor, but over the course of those 2 weeks, were there some notable things that you learned?
Well, again, just an appreciation for the problem. until you get on the ground and talk to the people that live it, you can't really understand and appreciate it. And I guess I did want to at least share this. During the course, there was a gentleman from the Congo, DRC, Democratic Republic of Congo,
mm-hmm.
who was he was a ranger. I think he was up in management in the ranger services. You know, he had a fairly tough personality, was asking tough questions. At the end of the course, the last day, we offered the participants just an opportunity to talk generally about how we're going to stop this sort of philosophical discussion. He gave a very impassioned speech about we need to change the hearts and minds of our own people rather than complain about everybody else. And that when the people of those countries begin to value the wildlife not as a poaching resource but as part of their heritage, then maybe they will help protect their own resources. And it really struck me as that is where there will be change. There's a lot of work to be done on the consumer countries like China and limiting demand. When they understand and appreciate their own resources as for what they are, which is, you know, the living resource, not a one to be harvested, then they'll have some impact. I talked to them afterwards, of course, as well as I could because there was a language barrier. But he was actually going to live it. He was leaving the service.
Oh wow!
To go teach at a school to actually live what he had pronounced was needed to be done. And I just thought that was an incredibly moving story that he felt that impassioned about what he was doing that he was going to actually go try to do what he said had to be done. That was one of the big takeaways I had, and these people are really devoted to protecting their resources. It's an uphill battle.
What kind of people would he be sending out then after they had some instruction from him? How did he see the next step unfolding?
Well, he was going to actually teach at a college just about ecology and wildlife preservation.
Okay.
He wasn't going to teach new rangers because, you know, those people are committed, hopefully themselves, but he wanted to begin to make a cultural change within their general population, starting with kids. You know,
to come at it from an additional angle, apart from the rangers that were already doing what they were doing.
Right.
Wow. Okay. Well, that does seem really encouraging, and he clearly was not just talking.
Right.
Yeah.
No, it had an impact on me.
Yeah. Well, that's great. Well, Jim, we have just about reached the end of our time. We've been speaking again with Jim Osterley, an assistant U.S. attorney for the Western District of Washington. And, Jim, thank you very, very much for making the time to join us on Talking Animals and talk to us about some really, really important issues. And it sounds like overall, not just with this man that you talked about, but generally from the course and beyond that even, that you feel sort of encouraged about the inroads that are being made and can continue to be made in terms of combating the trafficking?
Yeah, I think it's moving in the right direction. And I really appreciate the opportunity in the conversation.
Oh, great. Thank you again.
Okay. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Later on in the show, we'll speak with Talking Animals Greyhound correspondent Dawn Goldstein, who will help us sort out the recent machinations of Amendment 13, which seeks to end greyhound racing in Florida over the next few years. But a recent ruling by a judge has removed the amendment from the ballot. Decision the state is now appealing. Right now, though, it's time to step into the comedy corner for a brief but always timely piece from Tom Papa. This one's called Fake Service Dogs. From Tom Papa in today's comedy corner on Talking Animals.
No one can deal. How about these people with the fake service dogs? You see these creeps? Fake service dogs. There's real service dogs that help real people. Then a girl shows up with a Pekingese sticking out of a Hello Kitty handbag and tries to tell us it's working and then scams a certificate to show at the gate I have to have my puppy with me at all times or I'm going to lose my marbles. Oh, by all means, welcome aboard. What could possibly go wrong with your crazy ass at 40,000 feet?
That was Tom Papa with a short piece called Fake Service Dogs, taken from his album entitled Human Mule. Now let's get some greyhound guidance and expertise from Don Goldstein on Amendment 13, for which things have gone a little wayward in recent weeks. This is Don Goldstein back with us on Talking Animals. Good morning, Don.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you today?
Great. Thanks for joining us again on Talking Animals. So let's quickly, just to, for any listeners who might not be kind of familiar with with everything that sort of preceded what we're mainly here to talk about today, maybe you could just sort of review what Amendment 13 is and how it wound up on the ballot before other things happened recently.
Sure. Amendment 13 is an amendment that would ban in-ground racing in the state of Florida over a 26-month period. It was placed on the ballot by the Constitution Revision Commission, who they put actually 8 amendments total on the ballot. So that's where it started. On the 1st of August, a judge in Tallahassee, district judge in Tallahassee, ruled in favor of the Florida Greyhound Association, who had sued saying the ballot measure was confusing and didn't do what it says. We don't agree with that. We, the Committee to Protect Dogs, as well as the state of Florida, the state immediately appealed that judge's ruling, and it is now before the Florida Supreme Court and will be heard on the 29th of this month. The effect of that appeal is that the ballot measure, that the amendment, is back on the ballot. If the ballots were to be printed today, Amendment 13 would be there.
Okay, well, that was one of my follow-up questions, so you've already answered that. Here are a couple other questions just to address some of the things that you just kind of quickly summarized there, which was great. Now, why did the suit go to this judge, Judge Givers, I guess? I'm not sure how to pronounce it, but...
Yes, it was Karen Givers.
Yeah. How did it end up directed to her?
I don't know how the assignment process goes. I don't know whether the FGA was able to pick a court or whether it just wound up in her court. I can tell you that she is frequently overturned.
Okay. So she has that type of track record. But
yeah, and this kind of lawsuit, was it... Frankly, it was expected. FGA, from the very beginning, had threatened to sue, and we knew they would. And it was a pretty obvious effort on their part. If this goes to the people, they're going to approve it. It's going to get, we guess, our latest poll shows about 70% of the Floridians are in favor of Amendment 13, of ending dog racing, this cruel and inhumane industry. So they had to try something. But I'll also tell you that, as of right now, of the 8 amendments that the CRC put forward, 7 of them have gone to court trying to block it.
So
this is a normal thing.
Right. So this was expected in this case in particular, and sounds like standard when there's any kind of constitutional amendment added to a ballot.
Yeah, and the good news is, from our point of view, is it's a very, very high bar to get an amendment kicked off the ballot. It's a very high bar in Florida. The Constitution itself gives preference to an amendment that has made it to the ballot. So it's going to be an uphill battle for them to win. And again, it was passed through the District Court of Appeals with their approval and passed directly to the Supreme Court just because of the time constraint. And both the FGA and the state of Florida and the animal division of the Florida Bar Association all appealed and said, look, this is going to go to the Supreme Court no matter what. Whoever loses at the District Court of Appeals, they're going to appeal it to the Supreme Court. So you might as well just pass it on. The Court of Appeals agreed with that and passed it directly to the Supreme Court.
So that's who hears it on August 29th?
Correct. The Florida Supreme
Right.
Court will hear it on August 29th. We expect a ruling fairly quickly after that. Again, the bar is very high. There's lots and lots of precedents, again, because this is kind of a normal process. But there's a lot of precedent that we feel that Judge Givers totally ignored.
So it sounds like everybody's quite confident. And again, something you mentioned earlier in this conversation was that regardless, if Election Day was today, it would be on the ballot. So when people say that it got removed by her decision, I guess that removed is in quotes in that sense.
Very much so. And
yeah.
As soon as it was appealed, that automatically put a stay on her decision, which means
okay.
Her decision doesn't exist until it's approved by a higher court.
Okay.
In this case, the Supreme Court.
Right. Okay.
It's kind of funny. She said that it was misleading because it wouldn't stop greyhound racing in other states. We think that the voters in Florida are perfectly capable of understanding this is an amendment to the Florida Constitution. Therefore, has no effect on other states.
Yeah, that did seem puzzling because it's always been strictly about Florida, where, yeah, there's way more greyhound racing than anywhere else at this point
right.
in the U.S.
Yeah, as you know, out of the 17 tracks in the country, 11 of them are here in the state of Florida.
Yeah, but I don't think even there was any way to really misread that, or I wouldn't have thought, at least until this, that you could say, oh, well, this more broadly covers other greyhound racing or greyhound racing tracks. So anyway,
it's hard to believe how anybody would misunderstand that. We firmly believe that Amendment 13 says what it does and does what it says.
Okay, so we will keep a close eye on August 29th, I guess.
Absolutely, that will be broadcast. Anybody's interested in watching, as always, the Florida Supreme Court hearings are on the Florida Channel.
Okay, great. Well, this we'll keep an eye on that even more directly then. So, Don, thank you once again for helping us sort out and puzzle through some of these things, and we'll be speaking again, I'm sure.
Thanks for having me, Duncan, as always. Bye-bye.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Loray and Radioactivity, kicking off a three-hour block of interviews, phone calls, news, and more, including the noon hour midpoint with Nola Lillay. Then at 1 p.m., John Gilmore presides over executive session. Then the music kicks back in at 2 p.m. with Scott Elliott and the All Souls edition of It's the Music. Meanwhile, on this show, as the prize for Name That Animal Tune, I'll be offering a pair of tickets to see Bob Dylan October 20th at Ruth Eckert Hall. In fact, let's get to that now. So this is a Name That Animal Tune, which is a giveaway. Please only participate if you haven't won something from WNF in the last 90 days. And there'll be a prize again, that pair of tickets to see Bob Dylan, Ruth Eckert Hall, October 20th, to the first person who calls 813-239-9663 and correctly identifies this animal song. My feeling is that to win Bob Dylan tickets, you should be able to identify a Bob Dylan song, which, all things considered, might be a pretty big clue here. It's Name That Animal Tune on Talking Animals on WMNF. All right, we will take our callers. We got a few already off the air. Let's see who wins the Dylan tickets, because we have just about reached the end of today's edition of Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Rob Loray is up next with Radioactivity. Next week, my guest will be Brenna Donnelly, the founder of Rescue Rebuild, which travels the U.S. with college students and others and rebuilds animal shelters or upgrades them to make the work easier and better at those facilities. So we'll hear all about that. Meanwhile, I invite you to visit TalkingAnimals.net for audio archives of every show we've ever broadcast. iTunes podcasts are available there as well. There are also links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and more. Please like us on Facebook, the show, and or me personally, and follow me on Twitter. You can also subscribe there to our e-newsletter to find out about our guests a couple of days beforehand and other news from the Talking Animal world. That's all found at TalkingAnimals.net. I'm Duncan Strauss. Thanks very much for listening. Have a good week. Be kind to animals. Be kind to others. Be kind to yourself. This is Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa, Brandon, Clearwater, Largo, Weekiwachi and beyond, community conscious radio, the last local radio station in Tampa Bay. NPR News is next.